Hello and welcome to the Yay Yoga podcast. I'm Renee Liu. You may know me as a yoga teacher, and today I'm the host of this podcast where I talk to the most inspiring teachers from around the world about their yoga journey. Today I'm talking to Susanna Barkitaki. She's a Yoga Unity activist, teacher, speaker, and author of the book Embracing Yoga's Roots. Her main work is about sharing ways in which we can teach and practice yoga in the modern world while still honoring yoga culture. And so that's the main topic of today's conversation. We'll discuss cultural appropriation, colonization, and how it influenced the way yoga was introduced to the West. And we'll talk about whether you should speak Sanskrit in your class and whether you should end your class by saying namaste. Welcome to the Yay Yoga podcast, Susanna. I am so grateful to have you here on the show. You are right now, you're in Orlando, right? How are you feeling today? And just in case someone doesn't know you, can you quickly introduce yourself and tell us what you're working on?
Absolutely. Hi, Renee. Hi, everybody who's listening in. I'm so happy to be here. I am in Orlando, Florida, which is unceded Seminole territory in the southeastern part of the United States. Although I'm originally from England, so from Europe, I was born in England, and my family is also from the northeast of India, in Assam, in Bengal. And I like to say all that because sometimes it's nice to know everywhere that someone is from and all of the strings that weave together the tapestry of who I am. And that's actually a big part of what I do in the world, which is look at what causes separation and then what brings us together for ways to kind of find more unity in ourselves and in the world. So the way that manifests is, I would say I'm like a yoga unity activist. I write books, I write blogs, and then I also am an educator and a teacher on yoga ethics.
Yes, beautiful. So wide and so broad the work that you are doing. A question that I'm asking to all my guests is, what is yoga to you?
I love that. So yoga to me is really a codified, organized system of how to live in the world. And so it's a project of, and has been for thousands of years, a project of big questions like, you know, what is right? What is the right way to be? How should we live? And then also, how should we be with one another? What will lead us towards liberation, towards freedom, personally and collectively? And so yoga, you know, if I was to boil it down, is an organized, codified system of personal and social liberation.
Wow. It's a very original answer. Like, I've spoken to a few people now for this podcast, and of course, there's some overlap always, but it's so interesting how people react differently to that question. And I think it's just this question that immediately implies that yoga is this big thing and there's so many spectrums. And thanks for sharing that. I want to start at the beginning, actually, and that's your childhood, because you mentioned already that your family is from India. So maybe you can tell us a bit how your childhood was and if you were brought up with certain Hindu traditions.
Yes. So, you know, I was brought up, you know, I lived in England with my family. My mother's British, my father's Indian, and I was brought up with meditation, with, you know, yoga practices like mindfulness and yoga ethics. And I think it's really important to note that even though there are different definitions of what yoga is, any definitions that don't incorporate the ethics, right? Like, yoga really is and has always been a whole system of philosophy looked at the best ways to live. What is the perfected experience of being human? Or maybe not perfected, but like, what is a good life? And so these are questions that we've seen in Western philosophy, but we also see in Eastern philosophy. And the way my family framed it was yoga was never just the purview of one religion. So even though my family is Hindu, yoga itself was sort of practiced pre-Hinduism and was explained to me more like, this is just how we are. These are the things that we believe or that we're grappling with and we're trying to figure out as what makes a good life, you know, and how to live ethically. And I think all of that is so important because if there's a definition that leaves those things out, then it actually is watering down what yoga is. And it's not looking at that full system, you know, so that's critical. But for me, you know, all these pieces were part of what were part of sort of daily life. You know, it would be like if I got sick or I wasn't feeling well, then my aunties and uncles would share an Ayurvedic remedy, a yogic remedy, a particular breathing practice, or maybe a certain herb. If I wasn't able to sleep, my dad would guide a meditation, a visualization, where, for example, imagining a blue light, you know, above the third eye, and then seeing it fill my whole body, you know, even as a child, and I would be able to then relax and do progressive body relaxation and calm down and fall asleep. And so for many Indians, for many South Asians, yoga is sort of the fabric and the backdrop of activities of daily life, of the way we live, the way we relate, what we eat, what we, you know, how we work. And I think that has been a big part of what I've seen as missing in yoga in the West is these simple things that are simple, but not easy sometimes, right? Because to make sure I'm telling the truth or not harming, all of that is so valuable that it's a challenge to actually do. And then it's important to practice and teach if we're devoted to practicing yoga itself, is to go in depth.
Yeah. And so you said that you were brought up in the UK, and until what age did you live there, and how did, yeah, where did you move to from there? Was that India to discover more about the roots, or how did your life evolve?
Yeah, so initially, you know, I did go to India, but not right away. Initially, we actually experienced a lot of violence for being an Indian family and a mixed family. And so in England, there was a lot of violence at that time. And so we had to leave the country just for safety. And so we emigrated to the United States for essentially asylum, you know, to get out of a situation where our lives were being threatened. And when we moved, and I think people don't realize this, you know, because it's like sometimes it can seem like, oh, you know, there's been like progress and all of that. But actually, even in my lifetime, we were not able to live at all, like even to survive in the UK. And then in the US, when we moved to the US, there was a lot of violence. My brother and I faced physical violence, like being beaten up for being brown, being called names, being told to go home, you know, which at that point was very confusing because where was home? And so all of that, you know, is part of the work that I do to not look away from the things that actually have caused suffering and to look below the surface of, oh, we have this melting pot of equality and diversity, but is it really equal? Is it really welcoming? And yes, we all share that ideal, but if we haven't quite gotten there because there are people being treated unfairly or unequally, then what can we do to try to make things more fair? And I think yoga is a very clear pathway towards that end. So yeah, we moved to the US and I grew up in Los Angeles area, which itself, you know, was a huge education in separation, and then also finding connection, finding unity. I had a group of friends who were from so many places. They were Native, Black folks, Latinx folks, folks from Central South America, folks from Europe, from all over. And we were all friends. And actually that group, was the group we were working on these issues of division and separation and how do we get to unity and all of that. And they were like, hey, maybe, because I was bringing, we'd start all our meetings with some kind of spiritual space or a meditation or a practice, and I would bring things from yoga culture. They're like, why don't you study more? Why don't you go further into this? And so it was really the support of those friends that helped me kind of turn into what it was that I had been made fun of for, like the parts of me that were different, and then be able to utilize those to find a voice and to find a vehicle for personal and social change.
And so how did you go deeper into that? Was that through studying, traveling, talking to people? Can you share a bit about that experience, that journey?
It was a big journey. I definitely had been doing some reading and some studying on my own. I decided to look for a teacher training taught by Indian teachers. And even in LA, I couldn't find that. That didn't exist. And at that time, a yoga teacher training, I don't know if it exists now. And so because of that, I decided to study Ayurveda first. So I studied the sibling science to yoga, which is like health and wellness. And I had a group of Indian teachers who came from India and would teach, ways to live, ways to be in harmony with the natural world around us. And because of that, I myself started to change. I started to be a little bit less like anxious and be a little more in tune, So through that, I was working as a teacher, as a high school teacher. And I realized, okay, I want to go and spend some time in India and study and practice yoga there. And so I left my job, which I loved, I loved teaching high school English and history. And I went to India and taught in a school in Bihar. And while I was there helping and, kind of being of service, doing seva, I also deepened in my own yoga training. And so it was this journey of study, intense study here in the US, and then intense study in India for over 2 years.
Wow. And you mentioned that meditation, as in when we're talking about certain practices other than the ethics, meditation was part of it, certain breathing exercises. At what point in your life did you go into an asana practice?
Yes, right. And so that's what's so interesting, I think, is so many of us, and maybe folks listening, we all have different ways in to yoga, and it is this organized practice, and asana is one of the wonderful limbs. We have so many wonderful limbs. And so I came in probably more through dhyana, meditation, dharana, mindfulness, and yama and niyama, the ethics, first. And then I came into asana, I would say, in college, and really when I was first starting to teach, because I was feeling so much anxiety, which maybe folks can relate to, like so much stress, so much anxiety, that I needed something that helped me move through that and find more peace in my mind, body, spirit. And really it was asana that helped me do that, that helped me kind of link up and reconnect my mind to my body. So I could, in the morning, before going in to teach 260 youth in Los Angeles public schools, I could be ready to face that day without totally freaking out, and all the distractions and the stressors that might come up, so I could really be there for those young people. And it was through asana and meditation that that I found that And then it was that same time as I was working that I understood, like, oh, this is a really powerful system. I've kind of had it all my life, but I haven't, like, paid it as much attention, you know? Like, I hadn't, it's kind of like when you have something in your back pocket and you don't really notice that it's been there. It's like, oh, this is really valuable. I need to go and study it deeper. I need.
Right. Yeah. And when you started to get into that asana practice, was that through a studio? Were you taking classes somewhere, or was it just your self-practice from the start?
You know, mostly it was like family taught, family led. So it was hatha yoga. So pretty simple, pretty slow. A lot of finding a pose and then breathing in that pose. Not as much of a vigorous practice. When I went into yoga studios in LA, I actually didn't feel welcome, you know, and this is a story I've heard from a lot of other South Asian and folks of color, you know, in the United States. I don't know how it is where you are. I'm really curious, actually, but where there's a certain look, right? There's a certain type of person that is a yogi in these yoga studios in the U.S., and that tends to be a certain norm, right? Which, and that expectation can make some people not feel welcome. And I certainly was one of those people who I'm not super flexible. You know, I had broken my leg when I was a kid. And so I would have an injury and that I'm, you know, that limited my flexibility. And then, so there were a number of factors, and then being brown, not having, like expensive clothes, all of those things made yoga feel a little like yoga asana in the West feel inaccessible. And I started to, at the time, I didn't like make the link of like, this isn't right. You know, yoga is for everyone. It's a practice of liberation. No one should be excluded. I just felt like maybe I was doing something wrong, which I'm sure people listening can relate to. Like if you feel like, oh, I'm not good enough, or I'm not flexible enough. We kind of can perpetuate this culture of perfection or this culture of achievement or competition that unfortunately is the antithesis of what yoga really is, but can be so much promoted in yoga today. And so I started to see that, and I found, I was lucky, I found, you know how sometimes there can be these really great teachers in a little hidden pocket, like this was a teacher at a YMCA, you know, almost like a community center. It was just a wonderful teacher, very inclusive, very welcoming. And there I got to go deeper into my physical asana practice. And, it, you know, people showed up in sweats. There were housewives. There were, you know, like scientists. There were all types of people, students. And we just got to come as we were, you know. And that ethic of being welcoming, inviting people in, having people come as they are, I think we're seeing more and more, and has kind of developed as a field of trauma-informed yoga or accessible and inclusive yoga, and really is part of what I think it means to embrace the roots of yoga as a practice.
Yeah, it's such a shame, right? How did yoga end up becoming such a, I don't know, a wide... white folks thing, right? It's crazy when you think about it. Even if you look at the demographics, like yoga used to be something that was mostly practiced by men in India, and now it's mostly practiced and taught by women that are mostly white. It's like, how did that go?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting, and I'm curious, first I'll answer that, but how is it where you are? Does it feel like there's a diversity of practitioners and teachers and people coming, and does it feel welcoming, or is it more like what I'm describing here in the US?
Well, it feels welcoming for me because I'm like the majority of practitioners, mostly white women. Well, that's me, right? So and I've always been, like you mentioned, that thing about being flexible. I started dancing when I was 5 years old. So for me, flexibility is just like, yeah, of course I'm flexible, you know? So from, like, if we're talking about physical stuff and like the way you look, I always felt welcome and represented, but it's not very diverse. No.
Yeah. And that's so interesting. So, and I appreciate, you know, and for folks listening too, it's not necessarily saying like you shouldn't be there, right? It's saying, well, who's missing? Like, can you look around the room? Can you look around where you are and think about who's not there and why might they not be there? And then also, like, could yoga help them, right? So here in Orlando, where I live, the majority of teachers are also white. The majority of practitioners are white. We do have some diversity, but the people who are missing are like veterans, right? Of all colors, veterans, young people, older people, people in their 60s and above, people who are court involved, right? Or have had some, you know, past criminal involvement. Like, they're not represented. Teenagers, not so represented. And could these people benefit from yoga? Well, of course, right? Just like you or I or anyone listening, we can absolutely, and they could benefit too. And so for me, it's about kind of looking at, well, who's not here? And then what could work to bring them in? So I want to go back to, well, how do we get here, right? How do we get to this issue? And in some places, like in parts of Europe and maybe where you are, or even Orlando, like you could say, well, there's just not that many people of color. And so we're not going to have racial diversity. But the thing is, and that may be true, and that's fine. But then there's all the other kinds of diversity, right, that we can look at: body size, ability. Like, would a studio be comfortable hiring a disabled yoga teacher and then running classes where there's accessibility for folks with different disabilities? And how important that is, because everyone would benefit, you know, all those folks would benefit. So how do we get here? I would say that really when we're looking at cultural issues in yoga, we have to look at the context of, you know, the relationship between the East and the West, which the beginning of that relationship, as far as we know, was colonization. And so for 400 years, the British and a couple other European countries, but primarily, you know, the British, the Dutch a little bit, the Portuguese had colonized India. And so for 200 years, that was economic rule. And then for the second 200 years, that was political rule. And then actually, yoga was a very useful tool, and ahimsa, a tool of nonviolent social change, where the dignity of those who were there as colonizers and the dignity of the colonized could be preserved as that political change was made for India to have self-determination. And I bring this all up because inherent in the core of yoga is the idea of svadhyaya, right? Self-rule, and tapas, like self growth and using one's energy for spiritual pursuits. So the movement for political independence was really founded in yogic. It was a yogic movement. It was a movement of swaraj, self-rule. Now, despite that, during that time, you know, there was the practice of yoga, Krishnamacharya and some of the other teachers who were teaching. And yoga came to the West from inside that colonial context. And what happens when there's one group that's trying to have domination over another group is the group in power often tries to put down the group that has less power. And so there were stories about, you know, Indians are inferior, Indians aren't concerned with ethics or what it means to be good, they're heathen, you know, those types of stories. And, you know, we, the British, are good, we care about, you know, all these things. And so all of that got taken out of yoga. that got taken out of what yoga is, which is why we got, in part, why we got the physical practice primarily, because it didn't serve the story of how this group could be made inferior and could be ruled to say, well, these are people with complex philosophical ideas about what life is and how to live a good life. Like, then it would make people question, well, why are we dominating them if they actually are grappling with big ideas of human existence? And that this doesn't make sense. You know, it kind of humanizes that group too much. And so all of that got stripped out of yoga. And then as it came to the West, it was primarily, you know, through the Parliament of World Religions and Paramahansa Yogananda speaking there, and then coming to teach in Los Angeles. So you've got this connection of focus on the body, teaching, coming to LA with all the external focus, you know, in Starlets and Hollywood and all those things in the early 1900s. And so yoga just became this kind of more externally focused practice as opposed to the full expanse of what it was. And then the people who were leading and platformed and growing, it's just become an outgrowth of that. And that's why I talk a lot about cultural appropriation, because it's not just like about fashion or about, you know, it's really about, well, we're missing the heart of what this practice is. And because we're missing the heart of this practice, we then deprive ourselves and others of access to these real tools for how to be free.
Right. So it's really lost in colonization.
Yeah, it's a lot about colonization, and that colonization is not just something that happened a long time ago, but that it's still happening now. And that unless we're aware of that, we're actually continuing to contribute to the colonization of yoga by not looking at and teaching and practicing the full expanse of what yoga is.
Yeah, right. Because it's just like it's still going on, but in a different way and maybe less visible. Right?
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so interesting. I read somewhere that you practice yoga in the lineage of Shankaracharya. Is that right?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Can you explain to our listeners who he was and maybe share some of his contributions to yoga?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, it's so wonderful to have and to get to study under like a yoga a teacher who has kind of a lineage and yoga as a full philosophical project, right? Like where it's not just the physical, but it's beyond just the physical. And so Shankaracharya was a non-dualistic Raja yogi. Some people call him Adi Shankaracharya or Adi Shankara. And he's considered one of the greatest philosophers of India. He, he influenced more modern gurus of India, such as Swami Vivekananda, Swami Shivananda of Rishikesh, Ramana Maharishi, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who taught the Beatles, Paramahansa Yogananda, who came to the West. And, you know, he really was a yoga Vedanta teacher. So what that means is he taught Jnana Yoga, or the yoga of knowledge. And that was Patanjali, you know, like how some of us might have studied the Yoga Sutras, but also other ways of making our practice concrete. So things like the chakras, mantra, drishti, the focus, chakras like the energy, mantra, the sound, yoga of sound, pranayama, the breath, concentration practices. And also he kind of founded and had a lot of work connected to glorifying and uplifting the goddess, the essence of Shakti in yoga philosophy. So including the divine feminine. So all of those aspects are what, you know, Shankara, he wrote, he spoke, he taught. He really questioned, I would say, like a kind of religious focus of yoga and the way that it was kind of getting, put into a realm of just religious or like Brahminical, like schools that were kind of elitist. And he tried to bring yoga into the practice of everyday people, inner and outer practices that everyone could have access to. And he really focused on the importance of vichara, or inquiry, inner inquiry, which is like jnana yoga, the yoga of knowledge. So he asked questions like, who am I? How did this world come into being? What caused the world? Who is its creator? What matters? What is a good life? And so all of these things are, I would say, the things that my main teacher, Shankarji, who is a direct descendant, you know, from teacher to student of the Shankaracharya tradition, was asking me. And so in general, you know, it's a school and style of yoga that is focused on inquiry and philosophy, but also on practical ethics, you know, a way of living in the world that makes it possible for us to find freedom, like me, myself, to find freedom, but for other people to find freedom as well. So it's an engaged kind of yoga. It's not just like a theoretical kind of yoga. It's like, how do we bring these things alive in the world right here, right now? I hope that's helpful. I know it can be a little bit abstract.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think for our listeners, it's very clear as well. And I love the focus on asking questions and swajaya. And is he also talking about karma action, the yoga of action, to live a life that is liberating for yourself and the people around you? Like, does it have a practical side as well?
Yeah, it absolutely does. It has a side where it's like how we live and what we do with our life is sort of a huge part of what it means to show up as a yogi today, right? So applying and being concerned with the kind of what do you call them? Like the things that we do day to day, moment to moment, how we eat, right? Like how we speak, how we relate with people. All of those things are that foundational inquiry of the yamas, of how do we not cause harm? How do we speak truthfully with other people? How do we not steal, you know, and be of service to others? All of that is a big part of this practice. It's an ethical and philosophical inquiry and a way of being in the world.
Oh, I love that. About non-harm, one thing that is often been said is yogis should not eat anything related to animals, right? That yogis should follow a vegan diet, a plant-based diet. If you look back to the history of yoga, what's your thought on that?
You know, this is a great question. So ahimsa, it's himsa is harm and ah is not, right? So it's not harm. It's standing up in the places where there's harm and then trying to address that harm. And so there's so many ways to practice ahimsa. It's not just about what we eat or don't eat, although that certainly is one aspect of ahimsa. It's not all of what ahimsa is. And so there's, you know, I would say it's like being aware that our actions cause suffering, doing our best to interrupt or change or take a different way to not cause suffering. So, for example, someone who's vegetarian but who is like in a position of power where they're oppressing, say, gender minority, right? Like, so it could be a vegetarian man or woman, and they're oppressing a minority group, or not allowing people to grow or move up in their career, they're causing a lot of harm. And so though they're vegetarian, they're causing harm in this other place. So it's really about looking across the board at where can we reduce harm? Well, why do we want to do that though? I think it's so important to say, for the sake of what are we reducing harm? And we're reducing harm, one, because obviously it's just the right thing to do to create liberation for all. But two, if you or I or anyone listening as a yogi, as a yogic practitioner, if we're causing harm, it's harder to have a peaceful, settled mind. And so it makes it a lot harder for us to achieve even our own goals as yogis. And so, you know, vegetarianism, one, there's a lot of benefits to it. Two, it's a way to cause less harm. But I just want to give an example. In India, there's a group of a religious group called the Jains, who developed out of that same time of Shramana Renunciate practitioners in early India that yoga developed from. And Jains take nonviolence, ahimsa, to such a degree that they wear masks. They've always worn masks, so they don't breathe in bugs, and they sweep the earth in front of them everywhere with a small brush to move the bugs away so they don't step on bugs. And so even those of us who are vegetarian, we still cause so much destruction of life, actually, through the farming of vegetables, through through the small life that are destroyed through the food that we eat. And so I bring that up not to make us feel hopeless, but to say the nature of the world is such that we always cause harm, right? There's always harm and healing happening in the same place. And so we're trying to reduce harm across the board, and we can't just say, oh, it's just about being vegetarian and now I'm done, you know, and now I've gotten, check that box. There's so many ways to practice ahimsa.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's really important to point that out, like even in the language that you use to others and also to yourself, that can cause a lot of harm as well. You know, it's in so many things. Yeah. Something you are very, very clear about is speaking Sanskrit, right? And I know that in a lot of yoga studios today where asana classes are held, they are taught in English only English, like the poses are called downward facing dog, warrior, 1, 2, 3. So no Sanskrit in class. Why do you think it's important to teach in the original language?
Yes, and I think this is so such a great question. You know, one of the main things that I'm here to do in my work of bringing yoga into the modern world while embracing and honoring its roots is really preserve the practice and the culture for us and for future generations. And so when you look at preservation of a culture, there's a few ways to do that. And obviously expanding and practicing the fullness of what all of what yoga is part of it, but also looking at the language that yoga was taught in and practiced in for thousands of years, and then using and holding on to the actual language is going to be a way to preserve it for the future. And so when you look at the names of poses in Sanskrit, there are names of natural forces, names of animals, you know, and so we get to turn into those more earth-based, nature-based practices instead of, for example, focusing on competition or focusing on alignment or focusing on, you know, am I doing this right or wrong? It's like, how can I move more like a dog? How can I move more like a cobra? What might it feel like inside to embody the rabbit, you know, while we're in the like Adho Mukha Svanasana, downward facing dog, or Bhujangasana Cobra. And so it's just a way of connecting us both to the intention and to preserving the tradition. So I think it is really important. It doesn't mean, though, that I think everyone should use Sanskrit all the time. And I also want to bring up that I know people are trying to be very respectful. I'm not saying the words wrong. And so I think for people who are practicing, it's just like, learn it, make it a point of study. You know, I have flashcards. I make flashcards for myself with yoga poses and Sanskrit names. And then you don't have to teach with it, but at least know it in your mind. So if someone asks you, and then often what I'll do is I'll say the pose either Sanskrit first and then English, like, okay, everyone, let's shift our hips back and bring them over our heels and find our way into Balasana, child's pose, right? So I just weave it in, not in a way to make anyone feel bad if they don't know the word, because also we don't want to make someone feel excluded for not understanding the Sanskrit either. So I like to work it in. And then also when I use, like I end my classes a lot with Om Shanti, 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 Om, the sacred sound of creation, preservation, ending, and peace, 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 I'll always translate it and then I'll chant. And so I think there's a
yeah.
importance there to like say what the words mean, don't just say the words. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's that's very important to make that combination, to make that translation for people to really be able to embody a pose, right? I mean, the warriors are these great examples of poses where you can really feel that strength from the warrior. And I mean, I know there's a very cruel story behind the warriors. we won't get into that today, but yeah, if you would just say Virabhadrasana to people that have never heard a Sanskrit word, then they wouldn't really feel that warrior strength in their bodies, I can imagine. So I think it's really important to make that combination and weave Sanskrit words into your way of teaching. Yeah. Yeah. And you mentioned that you always end your class by chanting Om Shanti. And I was wondering about Namaste, because I know you have a Namaste masterclass on your website. And in the Western world, often we end our class by saying Namaste. Can you share your thoughts on that?
Sure. So in general, you know, Namaste for me, it's something that in India, you know, we say to greet our elders, or we say to greet like a respected teacher. It's very formal. And we don't say namaste, we say namaste. So it's the emphasis is on the second syllable. And it's a greeting. And so it's a bit strange, you know, and I've heard this from other Indians as well, to hear it at the end of a yoga class. And so it's not so much that I'm saying don't say it, but it's more like, well, why are we saying it? And this is something I talk about in the masterclass, the Namaste masterclass. So if people are interested, they can check that out and watch it. It goes in depth into why we might say it, ask some questions, gets us to think critically, because as with all of this stuff, it's vichara, right? It's inquiry. It's like a conversation with ourselves. Why am I doing this? What purpose is it serving? Is it, am I really communicating and sharing what I want to share? And so for me, it just didn't make sense to end my class with what is traditionally a greeting. I felt like when we did do it, it was more just because that's what everyone else did. And it wasn't for a good reason. But I wanted a devotional, you know, an ending that had a a resonance. And the way my teacher, you know, Shankarji traditionally ends his teaching sessions is Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. And so that's generally how I end. I mean, I end it many different ways. I end yoga asana classes many different ways, but that's a main one that I use.
It is so difficult though, because I experiment with it. And so sometimes I'll end my classes saying namaste, and then sometimes I don't. And I notice that everyone's like waiting for the class to finish. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like everyone waits for like... And that for me also was like a sign that there's something a little off. If everyone's just expecting and using this sacred sound, sacred word, as like a way to say, all right, goodbye, everyone, we're done, you know, then maybe there's another way for me to signal, all right, we're going to close now with Om Shanti, 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 you know, as opposed to just saying namaste to like get everyone out the door, you know. So it's really an inquiry into like intentionality and mindfulness and thoughtfulness in what we're doing, without saying there's a right or a wrong here. There's just deeper exploration.
Yeah, I think you also give some examples of other ways to end your class, right, in that masterclass, or did I just make that up? No,
in the masterclass, and then on my blog, which is susannabarkataki.com, on my blog there's 60 plus ways to end your class, with a bunch of options for different
ways. Yeah. I'll link to that in the show notes.
Yeah, that's great. Wonderful.
Also, you have a book coming out soon.
I do, yeah.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah, there's so much to say, right, about how we can embrace the roots of yoga and go deeper in understanding all the different ways to practice. And so the book is really about how we can go deeper and understand what causes separation, reflect on our part and where we are, find a way to reconnect through action, and then move towards liberation and freedom. And so it's like a workbook. It's something to come to and to explore and to inquire and read and then write dog ear, you know, and then come back to and put down. So it's very practical, and I'm excited for it to come out. It's coming out in mid-November. And right now, folks can get a free chapter if they're interested in learning more. I speak a lot about how a lot of the things we're doing in modern yoga are actually found in the roots of yoga, in yoga culture. And so I make the free chapter is all about trauma-informed yoga and how you can find trauma-informed yoga in, you know, specific practices around Om or certain meditation practices. And it breaks all of that down while respecting and honoring the scientific advancements. Also looking at, well, where in yoga itself can we find these wonderful tools, and gives us some really concrete tools for how to deal with stress and deal with anxiety.
Cool. It sounds very exciting. Is it specifically for yoga teachers or practitioners or everyone?
Yeah, anyone interested in going deeper with yoga, learning more about yoga as a healing tool. Yoga was never, you know, again, like, out in India, you know, and in my personal life, it was just a part of daily life. And so it was part of like how to live, how to explore. So whether someone identifies as a teacher or a yoga practitioner, or is just curious, I think that it's very accessible as a way in to learn more.
Cool. How was that writing process for you?
It was quite a journey. You know, at first it was actually more like a series of personal essays, and then I realized I actually applied to a publishing house and they rejected it and said, no, you know, we need something a little more tight. And so then I wrote, like, turned those essays into a workbook, like a practical workbook, and then the workbook found its way back into becoming a book, and I decided to publish it myself as opposed to go with a publisher, just so the work could retain its freedom, you know, its academic freedom, and not be censored or changed or, you know, watered down.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I can imagine. Cool. So November is going to come out and it will be sold internationally, like everyone can just order it online. Yeah.
And then if you want to keep in touch and find out about it, probably getting the free chapter would be a great way, because then I'll know to send you a note of like, hey, it's available now.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Obviously, right now we live in a time where a lot of change is happening at a very high pace. Not just talking about COVID-19, I mean, there's Black Lives Matter, there's climate change. I think in America, politics is a topic as well at the moment. So I wonder, what do you think society needs most right now? And what actions can we take and others take to create that change?
Well, I definitely think it needs a call to pluralism and kind of an ethical foundation and a devotion to inquiry and to critical thought, like critical thinking. I think a lot of the problem we're seeing in the US is people not being devoted to deep inquiry or to science, you know, and so a lot of this can be found within yoga. So I would say start with ahimsa. Start with the roots or any of the yamas that really call to you, and go in there, explore there, and really begin putting the practice into every moment of your life. So yoga is not just something you do on your mat, but it's something you do moment to moment, day to day, in relationships, with kids, with friends. You know, it becomes a whole way of practicing ethics throughout one's entire life.
Do you have any recommendations of books, courses, or documentaries for people that want to educate themselves more on yoga history, yoga philosophy?
This is a great question. I think there have not been a lot of great books. I think there's a few that I would recommend. Indu Arora is a wonderful writer. She's an Indian woman. There are very few Indian women writers. Indu Arora has a great book on yoga. Shyam Ranganathan has a translation of the Yoga Sutras that I like a lot. I also like the Swami Shivananda translation of the Yoga Sutras. And in terms of yoga history, you know, I think we're seeing like scholarship right now be coming out and emerging. And so there aren't any great books currently that I have to recommend, but I hope there will be soon. I think there's a lot of writers that are emerging today.
Yeah. Cool. Interesting. Obviously, the practice off the mat is what we spoke about a lot and is actually what's the most important thing in the end. I do wonder about your self-practice. Like, what does it look like? Do you have daily rituals or anything like asana, meditation, or pranayama practices that you can share with us?
Yeah, I do. I always practice daily, at least, you know, some asana, some pranayama. And then, so some physical practice, kind of, again, slow, gentle hatha yoga, often, sometimes a more vigorous practice, depends on what is going on in my life. And then always every day, dhyana, which is meditation. And then throughout the day, I try to practice the yoga ethics and mindfulness. And so for me, I would say it's like the practice on the mat supports the practice of yoga through the rest of my day. And I'm really grateful for that. It's been a huge part of my life for the last two decades. And then finally, like gathering in community and sangha, you know, so with other people, whether it's in the classes that I teach or in classes that I attend, is being supported by people on the path, you know, people who are on the same kind of path, who care about these same things and can gain support and strength from one another. So all of those are the ways that I practice.
Do you work with certain themes? Like when you step on your mat in the morning, do you sort of check in and sense like, oh, this is something maybe from the yamas or niyamas that you want to focus a little extra on for that day or week? Or is that not something that's part of your routine?
No, that's exactly, yeah. So I usually just show up to my mat or my cushion and I ask myself, you know, what's going on today or this week, and what quality do I need to cultivate? And then I work through practice based on that quality. Or I may take a particular yama or niyama and be focused on, say, tapas and building fire, and like, what are the practices that can help me build that fire? You know, or svadhyaya and journaling and spending time in inquiry. So every week I would say it's a combination of always having a focus on the yamas or niyamas, and then something more emergent that might come out of what I'm needing in that moment.
Yeah, I can totally relate to that. And it's so powerful once you start to really tap into that on a daily basis as well. Yeah. What do you think makes a great teacher?
I mean, really, being able to share. I love teachers who can share the depth of the practice, like the yoga ethics that we're talking about, and then make it translatable and applicable to my life, and then their experience with it, you know, so they can kind of pull it full circle. I love that. And that's what I look for in teachers.
Yeah, I agree.
Oh, there's so many ways, so many different ways, you know, so that leaves it. There's not like one way that someone can be a great teacher. It's just, really, are they living and embodying yoga? And then how are they making that available to others?
Yes, totally. Do you have any favorite teachers that inspire you?
You know, that's a great question. Right now, I would say I am feeling very inspired by Jaisal Parikh, who is one of the co-founders of Yoga is Dead podcast, very kind of in your face, like critique of the yoga industry in the West, and Tejal as well, the other co-founder. I love them as teachers. Melissa Shah, who teaches a lot on pranayama. Also Arti Landrum, you know, so it's a lot of like modern Desi, meaning like Indian teachers in the diaspora, who are bringing like the depth of the tradition alive for our world now. And so because of COVID, we can practice with these teachers, you know, online from wherever we are. So I try to learn from and practice with them as much as possible.
Yes, that's definitely the upside of this crisis, hey? You can connect with everyone around the world. Yeah, it's amazing. Thanks for sharing that. I think we're coming to the end of our interview. So I have some rapid fire questions for you. Are you ready?
Yes, ready.
All right. What is the best advice someone ever gave to you?
I would say, from the Bhagavad Gita, do every action you must do, but do not be attached to your action's fruits.
Yes, beautiful. And so important. What advice do you have for yoga teachers that are just about to start their yoga teaching career and that are listening right now?
Yeah. Ooh, what a beautiful place to be. So really enjoy it and, you know, go deep into the full expanse of the practice. And then don't be afraid to make mistakes, you know, and to learn and to grow and to and to continue to get support for your learning and what you're doing.
Which book should be on everyone's bookshelf?
Absolutely, the Yoga Sutras or the Bhagavad Gita. And then any other books, I would say, by modern Indian authors about yoga. I think that'd be a wonderful way to learn and go deeper.
Do you have a favorite translation of the Bhagavad Gita?
You know, I like Eknath Ishwaran's. Yeah, I do like his. And I also do like Stephen Mitchell's, which is more poetic.
Okay. Cool. Who or what inspires you the most?
So many things inspire me. I think nature, you know, the earliest yoga practitioners were inspired by nature, by Agni, fire, Prithvi, earth, Vayu, wind. And so for me, it's that same inspiration of turning into the natural world and turning into these forces that are in us and all around us. And we can explore and are infinitely resourced and recharged by.
Yeah, and so powerful. What are you most grateful for today?
Well, I really am grateful to get to talk to you and to also know that there's folks listening who, you know, we're across the world, we may be in different parts of the world, but we're united by our shared values and this love of yoga. And I'm so grateful for that way of connecting through yoga.
Yes, it's amazing. It's wonderful. I totally share that. last question. What do you think I should speak to next?
Ooh, I love this. Well, if you haven't talked to Jaisalud Tejal from Yoga is Dead, I think that would be wonderful. I also think, so any of the teachers I mentioned, Melissa Shah, Nadia Gilyani, Kali Schutt, these are all, you know, contemporary thought leaders who are leading this call to really embrace the roots of yoga in various ways and in their various styles. And they'd all be wonderful, wonderful people to have on your podcast.
Beautiful. Thanks. I'll be sure to check them out. And yeah, thanks so much for your time. Is there anything else you want to add and you want to share with our listeners today?
I think the only thing is for folks listening, you know, just we're all here with that same aim of allowing ourselves to be vessels and vehicles for yoga to speak through us and to come through us. And so to really tune into the heart of that being a vessel for yoga and allowing it to move through you and deepening it in relationship with yoga, showing up to it however that looks. And I'm just grateful to have this conversation and to be here with you.
Thank you so much. If people want to find out more about you, where can they go to? Is that your Instagram and your website, I assume?
Yeah, the best place would be my website, Susanna Barkataki. And for the free chapter, you can put my name, SusannaBarkataki/book. And also on Instagram. I love to raise questions and have lots of discussion on Instagram.
Yes, cool. I'll make sure to link to all that in the show notes. And yeah, thank you so much for this conversation and sharing your story, all your knowledge. I'm very much looking forward to seeing your book. And I'm happy to reconnect around that time as well.
Thank you so much, Renee. It's so wonderful to connect with you and just grateful for you and for all of us for deepening this yoga together.
And that's it for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening. You can find the show notes at yeyoga.nl/podcast. And if you like this show, please show your support by hitting that subscribe button in your podcast app. Give us a high rating and share this episode with someone who might be interested as well. You can also follow me on Instagram at Renee Leeuw. That's R-E-N-E-E-L-E-E-U-W. I'd love to connect with you. Namaste.